It's about a week and a half since the NHL trade deadline has passed as we record this on Thursday. And Sean, I am freshly back from the general manager's meetings. Can I go back, please? Will they send me back to sunny South Florida again so I can do some reporting down there?
Maybe for the playoffs, Dan. There's a lot of good teams in South Florida. So, you know, maybe we'll get you back there. But tough gig you had 2 days in Florida while it was 29 degrees here and spring went away in the Northeast. So I'm feeling really bad for you.
So, Sean, we're about a week and a half now past the deadline. And so let's talk about who I think is the biggest player that moved at the deadline, Marc-Andre Fleury. He goes from Chicago to Minnesota, and here you are. Look at the Minnesota Wild as we speak right now. Winners of seven in a row, a winning streak that precedes Fleury's arrival there. He has played well. He's got wins in both of his starts, only three goals against. And you know what? Cam Talbot has been pushed as well, too. Cam Talbot's playing very well. He's 7-0 with a .932 save percentage since March 8th. 3-0. 959 since the arrival of Fleury. Look at the impact that Marc-Andre Fleury has made on the Minnesota Wild.
They've been fantastic, and they've really kind of, you know, solidified their place. And look, I think the one guy who can move like that and not upset the chemistry at all is Marc-Andre Fleury, because he's so good in the room. You know, I'm sure he's already pulled a couple of pranks, you know, that he's famous for. And you know, he sits right next to Cam Talbot in the dressing room, and they've started to form a bond. And you know, he's been really good when you think about it with all of his partners wherever he's been. And it's somewhat shocking because the job has been taken from him by each of them. Like, at some point you would think he would get a little jaded and be like, well, I'm going to take care of myself, but he doesn't. Like, it's not in his nature. So, you know, they've been great, and it should be, you know, as you said, we're recording this on Thursday. And unfortunately, Marc-Andre Fleury's not playing tonight. They play the Pittsburgh Penguins in what should be a great game, you know, top teams from each conference. And if Dean Evason had some flair for the dramatic instead of thinking about what's best for his team, he could have played Marc-Andre Fleury, and that would have added a little spice to the whole thing. But that is not going to be the case.
But I think that speaks to where the Wild are with their goaltending right now. And look, I'm not going to say Talbot's playing well because Fleury's there, because look, Talbot's run here that he's been on precedes Fleury's arrival. However, I do think, and we talked about this when we spoke the Monday, you know, that right after the deadline when we did our last show, that I do think the arrival of Fleury was going to push Talbot. And that might be part of this. That might be what's happening here, because like you said, Fleury has been the guy in wherever in the previous markets, and somebody has come in and taken his job. Matt Murray in Pittsburgh, obviously, and Robin Lehner in Vegas. Nobody took his job in Chicago, but he didn't have it there that long, right? He is now the guy coming in to try to take Cam Talbot's job. And that point right there might be pushing Talbot, which in and of itself makes the Wild that much better, makes the decision for Dean Evason once they get to game one of the playoffs for whoever they play that much harder. But I think that's the type of decision you want, rather than going into the playoffs going, which one of these guys can we survive with? Is instead he's saying, you know, which one of my two number one goalies am I going to play?
Yeah, it's an insurance policy. You're not staying up at night. There's a lot of reasons as a coach you stay up at night during the playoffs, but one of them isn't going to be what happens if my goalie gets hurt. And there's a lot of teams. You look at the Toronto Maple Leafs, right? Like, what's going to happen? Mrazek's hurt. Campbell's hurt. He's supposed to come back soon, but, you know, he's injured. And is he fully healthy when he comes back? And then you're down to Shulgren. If I'm Keith, like I don't know what I'm doing. Like, that's gonna petrify me going into the playoffs, especially as crazy as the East is. That's one worry that Dean Evason doesn't have. If he picks Cam Talbot and he's not good or he gets injured, it's not much to look down the end of the bench and say, hey, that guy's won three Stanley Cups over there. Let's throw him in and see what happens. So it's a huge luxury that they have, and I think, you know, it's reflective of the way the team's playing. You know, Billy Guerin's pushed all in and said, I believe in this team. This is the last piece that I believe they needed. There's no excuse now, and let's go and get it.
Yeah, no, and they're very, that whole story is going to be very interesting to watch. It kind of brings me, kind of reminds me a little bit. Remember in 2010 at the Olympics, they started Marty Brodeur and they had Roberto Luongo as the insurance policy, and they went to the insurance policy and they ended up winning a gold medal, Team Canada. So that one's interesting. Speaking of Fleury, his former team, well, former team now, the Vegas Golden Knights. Let's talk a little bit about this race in the Pacific with the Vegas Golden Knights. Logan Thompson has sort of stabilized things, or at least helped for a little while stabilize the goaltending there with Robin Lehner out. And here's Vegas, three wins in a row. They're in the second wild card as we speak. Logan Thompson's played in 9 straight games, starting 8 of them, 5-3, .916 save percentage. He's been solid. And they're also in a soft part of their schedule. I remember I wrote about this in the mailbag a couple of weeks ago, that Vegas was going to hit a soft part of their schedule from March 26th through April 12th. 7 games, 1 against Chicago, 2 against Seattle, 3 against Vancouver, 1 against Arizona. So far in that 7 games, they've beaten Chicago 5-4, and they've beaten Seattle 3-0. So that soft part of their schedule is where they had to make up the ground, even with all the injuries that they've had and whatnot, and getting guys back. And so far, so good for Vegas. And Logan Thompson's been the guy that's helped stabilize it.
Yeah, Logan Thompson and the guy that they didn't want. If Jenny Dadden,
that's right,
whose trade to Anaheim was rescinded by the league. There was issues with and there's no trade clause, and we'll talk about that a little bit when we recap your GM soiree later in the show.
Experience.
What's impressed me about them, and I have a lot of concerns about them. Robin Lehner may be back soon. He's on the road with them, and certainly that'll help. But it's just like Jack Campbell, like goalie injuries scare me because they try and rush to get back. They're never 100% until they have some true time to heal. But what has impressed me is the character that they've shown, right? Like that Chicago game on national TV got away from them quickly. And there was every reason to fold up the tent and say, we just don't have the horses. There's 10 guys on the injured list. Like, we're playing an AHL team, and let's just fold it up and go to the next town and see what happens. And they didn't. They came back and they won that game and got 2 points they needed. And then even last night, if they play that way, they're out in the first round.
Yeah.
You know, against Seattle. They
gotta get there, though.
There was nothing. There was nothing in that game. Yeah, they won 3-0, but there was nothing in that game that you were like, whoa, look, I think Vegas has figured it all out. They play that game against Colorado in the regular season, and they're going to lose 8-2. Mm-hmm. So there's still a ways for them to go, but I do appreciate their character, and I think it's going to be important if they last and they make it to the playoffs. They're going to have that institutional knowledge of, we were able to do this when the chips were down, when everybody counted us out. And now we're going to show everybody in the playoffs when they count us out. And we're getting people back. We have the mental toughness to survive a playoff series that maybe we don't belong in.
Well, they got to get guys back, right? I mean, they're not going anywhere if they don't get some of these guys back. And that's the biggest key for them. Quickly, though, we're talking all about the Pacific Division. Now, I do want to just tease our interview coming up here. We talked to our colleague, Emily Benjamin. She's based in Boston, but she did a terrific story on the Vancouver Canucks front office. So we'll be talking with, you'll be hearing that interview shortly, but let's stick, Sean, in the Pacific. So Vegas is right there. They're fourth. They may run out of runway. Okay. Cause they got 13 games left. They've played 69 games, but so have the LA Kings. And the LA Kings are similar with Vegas right now, right? Dealing with a ton of injuries. Drew Doughty, Matt Roy, Andreas Athanasiou, Dustin Brown, Mikey Anderson. Now Blake Lizotte is out as well, right? These are key guys in their lineup, and they're out of the lineup. And they're 4-4-3 since Drew Doughty left the lineup. We don't know when he's coming back. And if you look at the Kings, who are currently second in the Pacific Division, they just got to a shootout. And lost to the Edmonton Oilers. And they got to the shootout because for a minute there, the Oilers goaltending went, right? And they scored 2 goals in, 16 seconds. But the Kings, Calgary, Winnipeg, Calgary, Edmonton, Minnesota, that's their next 5 games. Like, and they're playing without all these guys. This is a dicey part for the Kings too, because we talk about Vegas and where are they? The Kings are only 4 points ahead, same amount of games. And you got teams like, you know, that are Dallas and Winnipeg is coming too, that Like there's you drop out of this, you know, LA could easily drop to fourth and out in the case of the Pacific.
You feel horrible for him because you never expected him to be here this deep into the season, right? Like it was supposed to be another bridge year until they got a little bit better, and they've exceeded all expectations and were playing really well. And then the injury bug hit. Drew Doughty, look, he has a lot of critics, but I'm not one of them. Like, I think he's so important to that team. Yes, he makes mistakes and you know, he's not the most disciplined defenseman that ever lived, but he gives that team swagger. And he gives them a belief in who they are and what they can do. And I think that's been missing. And it's going to be really hard to figure out. You know, I don't believe in the Edmonton Oilers at all. I know they've won 7 out of their last 10 games and have taken 15 out of their last 20 points. But the meltdown against LA last night, they had that game in control. It's a game they need to win. And they left it too late. They could have, you know, put that game away, and they can't. Defensively and goaltending wise, they can't. And then you look at the game against Calgary, you know, one of the most fun games to watch all year. Crazy goals. It was 6-6 early in the second period. You're like, I was doing something else. I saw it on Twitter. I'm like, oh, time to fire up that game, and never left it again. And you know, as a fan, you're like, oh, this is amazing. Look at all the skill out there. Look at them go. They couldn't buy a save, but they also couldn't buy their defensive zone coverage. Mm-hmm. They're all over the place. They don't pick up guys. Guys are walking right down the slot. So you want to kill Mike Smith and you want to kill Koskinen. Go ahead. Neither one of them have been great, but they are getting absolutely no help. And if you don't think teams are going to go into the playoffs, if Edmonton makes it, and look at them and say, I've figured out how to solve them in a long series, you are whistling past the graveyard, because they are going to be easy to pick apart, and they're going to have to win games 6-5 like they've had to every year of Connor McDavid's existence in the NHL that they've gotten to the playoffs. And it's a proven fact that you can't do it. Even with scoring up this year, you're not going to win a series 6-5 every night.
No, absolutely not. But that's a bigger point, right? Who do you believe in outside of Calgary in the Pacific Division? LA is banged up, not playing well. Edmonton, don't need to rehash what you just said. Everything, I agree with everything you just said 100%. Vegas, we talked about, right, with their injuries, and now they're coming on a little bit. They've hit a soft spot in the schedule. But even like you said, like, if they're not blowing you away with what they got, right, with the wins that they're getting. Vancouver, struggling. They're not, you know, they're kind of fading. And then you got, you know, like, you know, then obviously beyond that, you're talking about San Jose, pretty much out of it. Anaheim hasn't won a game since Hampus Lindholm was on their defense, and he's no longer there. And Seattle's out of the playoffs already. Who do you, is there a team other than Calgary that we're even saying has a shot here in the Pacific?
Maybe Vegas if they get healthy, just because they've been so good. And like I said, they've shown some mental toughness. But I could see 5 teams out of the Central. Yeah. You know, I really like the way Winnipeg's playing right now. Huge win last night in Buffalo against a Buffalo team that's ruined nights for a lot of playoff contenders who need points. Winnipeg finds out, you know, Nate Schmidt and Kyle Connor, COVID positive, can't play for the next 3 games. And you're like, all of a sudden you're like, here's 2 points that they absolutely need that they might not get. And they figure out a way to get it. And you know, they're going to start working their way home through Canada, and they need more points, but they're starting to play, I think, the way that I expected them to play all year. So I could see 5 teams from the Central and whoever survives in the Pacific. Look, Edmonton could make the playoffs because I don't know if there's anybody that can push them from behind, but if they do, again, if it's a 2-3, maybe they got a chance, because that 2 or the 3 is going to have the same issues, unless it's Vegas. I think Vegas would do a pretty good number on them. But then after that, I don't see how they match up against anybody.
Yeah. Well, the team to me to watch in the West right now that could, you know, kind of blow it all up for some of these teams is Dallas, because Dallas is a team that's playing better hockey right now, and they have 17 games left. They got games in hand on everybody. So that's going to be interesting. Like, I like the way Winnipeg's playing right now. I mean, they've been so streaky all year. I question when it's going to turn the other way, you know, and also Dallas has 3 games in hand on them. So that'll be interesting. But Sean, let's get to our interview with Emily Benjamin, we talk all about the, you know, the West here in the Pacific. She was out there in Vancouver earlier this month and just did a terrific job on a story on the Vancouver Canucks diversified front office with Emily Castonway and Cammy Granato as assistant GMs and Patrick Alvin as the first Swedish GM in NHL history and the second European NHL GM behind Jarmo Kekäläinen in Columbus. So here's our interview with our colleague, Emily Benjamin. Emily, thanks so much for joining us. So we got to get right into it. You did this big story. You go to Vancouver, boondoggle, by the way. You know, I want to go to Vancouver again. Just let's go through this story real fast because, well, let's not go fast because I thought it was awesome. The story with Cammy Granato and Emily Castonguay, just their roles right now with the Canucks, but bigger picture, their roles in hockey right now.
I think it's huge. This is a momentous time. And actually, as an aside to that story, it had been reported for a long time that Emily was the second female assistant GM in NHL history. I determined in the reporting of that she is actually the first. So this is big. This is a huge moment for Emily, for Cammy, and for the sport. I think we have seen in the last year, 2 years, this sport growing in leaps and bounds in terms of its embrace of women, of people of color, of different voices and different backgrounds, you know, in higher and higher levels of the sport. And I think it's really important and it's wonderful to see. And they're really embracing these roles.
Emily, what I found interesting was it goes even deeper than that. You know, Jim Rutherford's fingerprints are all over this. And in the story, he mentioned that, you know, he's wanted to expand the front office roles and bring in new voices. But he never wanted to force it, and it had to be right. And it's right here with both Emily and Cammy and Patrick Alvin, who's only the second European GM in the history of the NHL. So, you know, it's a great story, but it also goes just beyond this gender equality month story, which was kind of the hook that baited it here. And as you reported it, it went even further.
There's no question. I mean, this is a group that is really able to listen to people from diverse perspectives who have come up in different ways, whether it's as a Hall of Fame player like Cammy Granato, someone from the scouting world like Patrick Alvin, who's been with Jim Rutherford in constructing, you know, three Stanley Cups in Pittsburgh, whether it's the Sedins who come with all their knowledge. So I think it's funny, Emily was saying that meetings can be very long over in Vancouver because there are so many things to discuss, so many different perspectives to look through. And it does all start with Jim Rutherford, who is a very respected name. He has had a very big managing sort of tree. He has had a lot of success in bringing people along. And that's what he said. He said, I hope that these people also get to that level, that I am continuing to build that tree that leads to more general managers.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the tree already that he's got, right? I mean, Billy Guerin, Tom Fitzgerald, and Ron Francis are in it right now. Jason Botterill was, and he's still involved, obviously, with Seattle. There were a couple of things, though, within the story. And if you haven't read it yet, go on NHL.com and search it out. It's a terrific story, and it's a very important story here on the Canucks in their front office. But Cammy Granato's mother telling her when she was 12 years old. Now, this is a hockey family. We know Don Granato's the coach of the Buffalo Sabres, right? I mean, Tony Granato's at Wisconsin, had a long NHL career. Cammy Granato's mother, when she was 12 years old, she tells a story. When she was 12 years old, her mom said, you're going to have to pick a different sport. And she basically ran upstairs crying because, you know, mom said, go pick a different sport. And look where she is now. Could you get a sense from Cammy and also from Emily on, yes, this is an important part for, you know, what they're pushing for and their professional careers, but the emotion involved in this and how far it's come for them.
There's no question. I think that's especially true with Cammy. I mean, that scene of her being taken into the living room, a place that you went on basically Christmas and when you were in trouble, and she sat down and her mom sort of breaks this news of there's no path forward for you. And Cammy is strong-willed. She is talented. She is driven. She has all those attributes that make someone successful in whatever pursuit it is. And she said, no, I'm not going to accept that. I'm not going to just leave this sport that I love. Hockey is so important to me. And I want to be just like my brothers. I don't see any reason why I shouldn't be. And she kept going. She made a life. She made a career. She made new pathways for women in this sport. She got a little bit lucky in terms of timing with the Olympics and the success she was able to have there. But this is force of nature. And it is emotional, I think, for her to get to this point where she says, not only have I been able to make my life work in this sport, I have been able to sort of bend this sport to what I was hoping for. I was also able to make this work with my life, which is very important to her. She's based in Vancouver. She has always been based in Vancouver. That's what worked for her with the Seattle Kraken when she was able to scout for them. But also she has been able to open doors for future women, for the little girl, Meg, who said to her at the end of a press conference when she was scouting, you know, how do I become a scout? These are questions that for a long time, Cammy wasn't able to ask. And a lot of women weren't able to ask. And a lot of maybe diverse people weren't able to ask. And now they can. And I think this is a big moment for Cammy. And it is big for her to do it with another woman. That takes a little bit of the burden off. It takes a little bit of the pressure off to be perfect, which a lot of women in these positions feel. And so I think you're right. There is a lot of emotion that comes with this, but both of them are just sort of plowing through. It is face forward. It is what is next for the Canucks. It is how do we build this team into a winning team, a championship team? When's that Stanley Cup coming?
And the other thing that struck me was Emily talking and basically turning down the job. Shocking. I mean, it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. And then B saying once she took it that there's still this huge amount of pressure. Like, you know, look, there's pressure in management anytime. Jim Rutherford still feels pressure. He's won the Stanley Cup multiple times. But to hear her verbalize how much she feels the weight of the world still of women to make this happen and to make it happen right and to continue the momentum that's going on. It's a whole level of what goes into this job that until I read your article, I had never really thought of.
There's no question. And Emily is sort of in an interesting position. She really pushes back and has for a long time. This is not the first time I've talked to her. I talked to her when she was an agent a couple of years ago. I mean, she has always pushed back against the narrative of her succeeding while being a woman. She doesn't want that to be part of her story. She just wants to be a successful person in hockey, in the jobs that she has been hired for, that she is qualified for. And it's a really double-edged sword where some people say, okay, we need to show that women are succeeding to pave that way forward. Some people saying that, you know, I'm here because of the qualifications I have, because of how hard I've worked. And my gender isn't a part of this. And so I think Emily and Cammy sort of embrace it in a little bit of different ways, but they both, I think, feel a little bit of that pressure for sure.
And I'm sure that they would love for us to just be talking about the Canucks because that's what they are hired to do. So let's do that because I love the way in the story, you painted the picture of, you know, there's Emily's office, Cammy's office, Jim Rutherford there, the Sedins, they're on the phone in an adjacent office. In the middle of all of it is Patrick Alvin, who is the general manager in charge of this thing now. And you also sat down and were able to talk with him for a while. This was your conversation with Patrick Alvin was pre-trade deadline. So now it's post-trade deadline. We know they made a little bit of moves, but here they are. They lost last night. We're recording this Thursday. They lose on Wednesday. They're 5 points out. They only have 13 games left. They're still trying to make a push. But what was the sense you got from Patrick Alvin about the long-term viability of what he's trying to do here? And you know, I mean, obviously the big question with Vancouver is JT Miller and his future, but just his sense of where this is right now with Vancouver and what they need to do to push forward.
I think they have the ability to be patient. And I think that was his sense pre-trade deadline. It sort of was borne out at the trade deadline. They didn't make a ton of waves. They didn't move any of those big names like JT Miller, because those guys that were under consideration to be moved all have more time on their contract. So they're still under control. They can revisit it in the summer. And that was really my sense that I got from Jim Rutherford, from Patrick Alvin, from Cammy, from everyone in that front office, was that we have the ability to sit down to understand exactly what our franchise needs and then to move and not to do anything rash, but they definitely feel like they need to change attitudes. They need to change some sort of methods internally of what they do. They're able to sit back and say, okay, how do we work on the scouting, the development, everything, all the pieces that they need to get to that championship level. I mean, Cammy talked for a long time about a winning mentality, and she said, we don't have that. And I think they were getting that, and you could hear it in some of the things, say, Quinn Hughes was saying around that time when they were really playing very well and winning a lot of games and maybe getting back into that postseason conversation. But I think they're taking sort of a measured approach.
And they press pause on maybe the biggest question they face is, what are they going to do with JT Miller? Right, he's got 1 year left. That was attractive at the deadline, because then you get JT for this year in a playoff run, playing really well, and one more year. But there's going to be a bigger market for him, say the draft or in the summer, if they decide to go that way. But you talked about a winning culture, and it seems to me he's the guy who's kind of taken that lead. You know, they lost the other night, and he basically put it all on him. And it wasn't all on him, but he came out post game and he said, you know, I wasn't ready. I needed to be better at the start of the game. There were things I did wrong. That's what a team that needs to win, wants to win, needs from its leaders. So to me, that's probably one of the biggest questions that the Canucks face, no matter what happens this year.
No question. And Alvin said to me, he said, you know, that's a conversation we're open to. And we would, you know, we would hope that we would have a long-term future with JT Miller. Whether that happens remains to be seen. But, you know, I think he has fit in very well there. He does bring that winning mentality, and he has been very, very good there. So, you know, I think it lines up if it makes sense for them, if that's the direction they're going, he should stay in Vancouver.
It's amazing how far JT Miller has come since he was a young player with the New York Rangers. And Elaine Vigneault basically said, if he doesn't figure it out, he's going to be a good American Hockey League player. You know, I mean, it is just outstanding. But for you, Emily, let's bring it closer to home. So we talked a lot about the Canucks, but you're in Boston. I mean, the Bruins are the team you cover the most. And they're honoring tonight against the Devils before the game. They're honoring Tuukka Rask for his career with the Boston Bruins, which obviously leads to the question of Jeremy Swayman. Like, Sean and I are big fans of Jeremy Swayman. We had him on the podcast. He was great, an excellent guest. I know you've chatted with him too a lot. But is that the biggest question for the Boston Bruins right now, the goaltending? Because the experience, it used to be you go into the playoffs, you're the Bruins, you're like, well, we got a guy in net who's been there, done that, right? They don't have that now.
Yeah, there were no questions for a lot. That was like that one position that you're like, whether or not Boston's fans believe it, it was like, this position is set. You don't really have to worry about that. But yeah, I mean, this is a big moment for Jeremy Swayman. I actually got to spend for a preview future story, some time with his dad this week, who is delightful. As you sort of would imagine, mm-hmm. having gotten a chance to see Jeremy Swayman. But yeah, this is a big question. How does he handle it? How does he, you know, how is he playing in the next month leading up to the playoffs, and then how does he handle that pressure? I mean, to me, so far, he is a guy who has not wilted under pressure, who has been able to take those big moments in stride. But this, the playoffs are a lot different, and there's a lot riding on his performance.
Do you believe this is a big enough sample size that the Bruins are comfortable with what they have? I mean, you look at him, he's got a .920 save percentage. Andre Vasilevsky has a .919 save percentage. There's goalies that obviously have better ones, but there's also goalies that we really celebrate. UC Saros is another one in Nashville. Like, people are like, oh, well, Nashville's a middling team, but UC Saros can get them to the promised land. He's at .921. Like, so Swayman's right in there, but again, a smaller sample size and maybe a little bit lesser competition. I mean, Vasilevsky's done it twice in the playoffs and gone the whole way. So we can forgive him for being a little more mediocre during this regular season. But do you believe that the Bruins have seen a big enough sample size where they're comfortable?
I think so. I think they have to be. I mean, do they have any other choice? I mean, yes, they could throw Linus Ullmark in there, but I don't think you would necessarily have the same questions about him. I think this is, you know, throwing the kid in the deep end and you're going to see, does he sink? Does he swim? Is he ready for this? And that's the choice they have. So the good news is they shored up their defense. They got Hampus Lindholm. So you have an even stouter defense in front of him and we'll see. I mean, this is supposed to be, Jeremy Swayman is supposed to be the future of the Bruins in goal. So here's his chance.
Let's see what he does with it, right? I mean, so that's the biggest question on the immediate thing for the Bruins. But the biggest question for the Bruins is involving Patrice Bergeron. You got any sense of what Patrice Bergeron might do after this season?
I think he's still undecided. I truly believe that he is still figuring this out. I had a conversation with him back before the All-Star game, and he was really sort of seemed to be deeply conflicted and really isn't sure. You know, he has a lot of things to answer, a lot of, you know, I think he needs to make sure his health is there. He needs to make sure his desire is there. I mean, he is playing as well as he has played in his career. He is, you know, very likely Selke Trophy candidate. This is a guy who is still at, if not the peak of his abilities, pretty darn close. But he's 36, and that is, you know, while in the grander scheme of things, not that old, he's getting up there in hockey terms, and he has a lot of miles on him. He has had, a lot of playoff runs, and he's been in the NHL since he was 18. This is a long career. And so I think that, I mean, the Bruins certainly will take him back, you know, begging and, you know, pleading if he's interested. He, you know, I think there's no question that he will be a Bruin as long as he wants to be a Bruin, but how long does he want it? Even Don Sweeney the other day said, I don't know. And I haven't asked. So Don Sweeney said, I haven't asked. He'll tell me when he's ready to tell me.
Do you have any concern after the game against the Maple Leafs? The Bruins had been playing so well. They had been maybe the best team in hockey for a stretch there. And I thought answered a lot of questions about who they are, getting some depth scoring from DeBrusque. And, you know, quietly, Taylor Hall is having a really good year. Like, people have written him off since his MVP year. He's got 50 points. I mean, we're not talking MVP anymore, but he's kind of been in the wasteland for a while and seems to have figured it out a little bit. But then they have a complete stinker against the Leafs, who they've owned forever. 6-4, I think, was a flattering scoreline to that game. It wasn't even close. Do alarm bells start going off for you, or is that just there's so many games in a row now and you're going to have a clunker every once in a while?
I think the latter. I think if we see this snowball, I mean, if we see this, sort of roll over into any of these upcoming games, I mean, they have the Devils on Thursday. They have, some maybe easier competition. They have Columbus on Saturday. If this rolls over into multiple games, I think maybe you do have a question, but I think sometimes you're just going to have a game like that. And, you know, sometimes it's just not going to work. They have played a lot of really good teams lately and played really well. They had a great game against the Tampa Bay Lightning last week. So I wouldn't be concerned, but you know, I think you sort of keep monitoring it, see how they continue to play. But right now I don't think it's a big deal. And, you know, Taylor Hall getting David Pastrnak on his line, that didn't hurt for sure.
No, that doesn't hurt. All right. So as we talk right now, Thursday morning, the Bruins, if the playoffs were beginning, I love that. If the playoffs begin right now, not everybody's played the same amount of games. So, but they would play Carolina barely, because Carolina has played one more game than Florida, but there's Carolina as a possibility. There's Florida as a possibility, Tampa as a possibility, Toronto as a possibility. I mean, any one of these teams is really a possibility. Is there a team that you think the Bruins match up well against, or, you know, would like say, oh, okay, we're feeling good if we go play that team? I don't know if anybody's feeling good about any team they play in the East, but you know what I mean.
Is it weird if I say the Tampa Bay Lightning? You would hate, no. It is a strange thing to say about the two-time defending Stanley Cup champions, but they have played the Lightning very well this season. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of experience, as Sean was saying, in net with Vasilevsky versus Swayman. But, you know, so far this season and the way I've seen them play these good teams, I think Tampa might be the one that they want potentially in that first round. But it really is unbelievable how good the East has been. We were talking to Brad Marchand the other day, and he said, you know, it's going to be a crazy playoffs. He's like, you're basically going to have to win 4 Stanley Cup finals a series. He's so excited. It's going to be a lot of fun. And you know, he doesn't seem to be wrong.
Who do you like out of that? I mean, the East has been set for a while. We know who the 8 teams are, unless something completely wild happens. But, you know, as you've seen all these teams players, they're one that jumps out at you and you say, hey, that's the team that I think can win 4 Stanley Cup finals in a row.
I like Florida. I do. I like Florida, and I kind of want to see it happen in Florida. So maybe it's a little wishful thinking, maybe not. I don't, but you know, they obviously don't have the experience like a lot of these other teams in the East do. It's hard to say that against teams that have, as we said, won the Stanley Cup, but I don't know. There's something about Florida this year that I just like.
They score a ton of goals. I mean, they have, I think as of now, 268 goals, which is already a franchise record for them. And I did the stat in Super 16. It's up now on NHL.com for the Panthers. They've scored three or more goals in 32 of their last 37 games. Now, obviously in the playoffs, if you score three or more goals, you got a pretty good shot of winning a game the way the playoff hockey is. The question I have with Florida, and Emily, you tell me if you agree, can they keep out of them? Can they keep it to two? Like, that's the question, right? Can they keep it to two in the playoffs? Because getting four is hard. Now, they can maybe for a run of four or five games, but over the course of trying to get 16 wins, you're not going to average four goals a game. So you're going to average in the threes. Can you keep it in the twos is the question for Florida.
I think you're absolutely right. That is the question. And we'll see. I mean, we haven't seen them in this situation enough to know how they bear down, how they figure it out in a series, which is not just, you know, one-off against a team. I think when you are able to game plan and really look deeply into another team, we'll see how they do. But yeah, I mean, certainly keeping it out of the net is going to be their biggest question going into the playoffs.
And they have to have Aaron Ekblad back and healthy.
Yeah.
He can't be playing on one leg. You know, obviously he's huge offensively, but he also sets their defense in a way that they're a little bit more responsible than they would otherwise be. So hopefully he's back and healthy.
Well, but who do you guys have? I can't be the only one going out on a limb.
All right, here. So to me, I'm going Tampa until somebody knocks him off. Like, just like we have the institutional knowledge of what they are. They're four line deep. Their D is strong. They have arguably the best goalie, right? Going. They have the ability. They don't lose more than two in a row in the playoffs. They haven't yet. So I think it's going to go either one of two ways for Tampa. I think they go on another long run and potentially win it again, or at least get close, or they flame out quick. Like, it's going to be I don't see an in between for the Lightning, but I'm going with the former. I think that they can go on another long run because of everything we know about them. And the most amazing thing to me with the Lightning is that hunger is still like it hasn't waned at all. And I think the big thing is they've gone out again and they get guys who haven't won in a while. You know, look at Corey Perry, Pierre-Édouard Bellemare, now Brandon Hagel. And, you know, they go out and they get these guys that come in, and that hunger that those players have, it continues to drive the hunger of the guys who've already been there and have won.
I mean, fair.
There, right? Fair. I mean, I'm going with the two-time defending Stanley Cup champs. So, you know, really out on a limb here. Sean, what about you?
Hey, look, I think Brad Marchand's right. Like, I think anybody can win it, and there is no chalk pick. So I'm not even going to give you a hard time about picking Tampa, because they're going to be hard-pressed to win three series to get to the final. I'm a little bit torn. I kind of have two teams, and so I'm going to say they're going to meet in the Eastern Conference final and then let them figure it out. But to me, it's Carolina and Pittsburgh. I don't think Pittsburgh gets the credit it deserves. I don't think Sidney Crosby gets the credit he deserves. He has been unbelievable since he came back from offseason surgery. He started the season late. He should be in the MVP conversation. What he's done has been unbelievable. Their goaltending scares me a little bit. Tristan Jarry's been good, but we have the institutional knowledge of what they've done in the playoffs. And until that is countered, you wonder. And then to me, like, Carolina might be the most complete team right now when you think about offense, defense, goaltending, everything that goes into it. Like, to me, they're a team that could shut down Florida. When you say, can Florida, you know, score at will? Can they score at will against Carolina? I don't know. Freddie Anderson's been fantastic. Their D is deep and completely underrated. And they could score some goals. They could play in a track meet just like Tampa did against Florida last year, if you need to play that way, but they can also shut it down like Tampa did last year. So they're probably, and that, again, that's a chalk pick. They're right at the top of the standings, but those are the two teams that I really look at and say, I think that's where we're going to be in the Eastern Conference final.
There's one team that before we let you go, Emily, there's one other team that we should touch on in the East, the New York Rangers. And I'll give you a couple of stats. So first off, the Rangers have won four games in a row now. I thought it was a gutsy win. Yes, it's against Detroit. A lot of teams are beating Detroit, but they were down in that game. They were able to come back, and then they win it in overtime. Andrew Kopp has made an impact on that team. There's no question about it. He gets the OT winner. They've beaten Pittsburgh twice in the last week. They got another one against them Friday night. the Rangers have won four games in a row against teams in the Eastern Conference playoff right now. They're 10-2-0 against those teams since December 31st and 13-4-0 this season. They're beating the good teams all around them. And I think that's an impressive thing for the Rangers. And they filled a lot of holes. The question still is, do they have enough? Emily, what do you make of the Rangers right now?
Well, first, I want to know what Sean thinks. I feel like I have spent all season, as you know, as a devoted podcast listener, listening to Sean not be convinced by the New York Rangers. So, so where are you, Sean?
I'm coming around. Dan can tell you.
Finally.
They're way higher in my Super 16 than they have been. Look, I think they did good things at the deadline. I think Kopp was great, completely unsung, and somebody that you know pretty well. Frank Vetrano has been phenomenal for them. I think the one thing that you were really concerned about with the Rangers was how top heavy they were and how they couldn't get their line set where you could find that third line, you know, that's been so key for Tampa and other teams that have been good in the past. And adding Vetrano and Kopp allows them to do that. Guys have slid down to where they belong and, you know, they're much harder to defend. And, you know, as the sample size gets bigger and bigger, like I keep wanting to say they're a goalie team, you know, and we've seen what happens to goalie teams, but the sample size is getting huge now. And how do you just say that he's going to start leaking oil, that Shesterkin's going to start leaking oil? I don't know that you can. He could be having a year, you know, like Dominic Hasek has had, like Tim Thomas had in the playoffs for the Bruins. Like he's playing at that level of hockey. So if that doesn't stop, watch out.
It really is interesting how when you sort of sort out those three top lines, that everything sometimes falls into place. I mean, that's what you saw with the Bruins over this last run. You move a couple guys around, you get DeBrusk up the top, you get Pastrnak down in the second line, you find out Charlie Coyle's line, and things fall into place. And you're right. I think that is what you have seen in New York. And Kopp has been better than I expected so far in New York. And that really makes things maybe a lot easier. And as for Shesterkin, I mean, if he hasn't started leaking oil yet, I think I have to give him the benefit of the doubt until you see otherwise.
He leaked it a little bit. He leaked a little oil a couple of weeks, you know, about a week or two ago, but plugged it pretty good. Anyway, they're good. The East is going to be fascinating. The Bruins are right in it. And Emily, thank you so much for hopping on with us. And if you haven't, go read her story on the Vancouver Canucks front office. It's a must read. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Really good stuff there from Emily, Sean. Let's just quickly tag this conversation we're having on the Rangers. The one thing I will say is they have 24 comeback wins this season, which is terrific, but it means you have to come back in a lot of games to win. And, you know, in the playoffs, it's hard to do that. But both of us, you know, Sean, this week in the Super 16, you look at our Super 16, they're number five. You know, in our overall Super 16, which is the combination of all 14 voters, you had them at number six and I had them at number six. A bunch of people had them, you know, higher than that as well. I think that kind of speaks where you had them and I had them at number six. We both had the same top five teams, just in a little bit of a different order. We were looking at, you know, Colorado, Florida, Carolina, Calgary, and Tampa. You know, you look at it where they are, I think that shows that we both believe they're sort of at the top right now of what we would consider probably the second tier, if you will. And that might sound negative, but it's not meant to be. You agree with that?
I do. And, you know, obviously we're joking with Emily, but I have steadily moved them up, and this is as high as I've ever had them in my Super 16. You know, I had to take the beating of Pittsburgh, who I would have liked to put ahead of them. I still think Pittsburgh's a better team, but they haven't proven it in the last two games. So, you know, for me, it's part present form. It's part who would win a series. To me, that series would be a toss-up, and it'd be a great series. But a recent form forced me to put Pittsburgh ahead, and to put the New York Rangers ahead, and we'll go from there, and we'll see what happens over the next couple of weeks and where it changes. But there was a lot of movement for me in the Super 16, not at the top. I think we all know who those teams are, but as you got a little bit lower, like I put Winnipeg back in for the first time in a long time. I moved Minnesota way up, you know, seven wins in a row. You can't knock that. So there was certainly Dallas, you know, you just mentioned they moved for me as well. But there was a lot of movement in the back half of the Super 16 just because of the way that teams are playing.
Yeah, you did have Winnipeg in at 15. I had Dallas, by the way, at 11. I moved them up higher too. You had them at 12. So we both are, you know, kind of on the Dallas bandwagon a little bit. But one thing I will say, like, I used to think the Penguins were better than the Rangers. I'm not so sure anymore. Now, and maybe I'm convinced by the last two games that the teams have played. One of them was a 5-1 blowout, but I kind of give Pittsburgh a pass, right? They're playing, it's their third game in four nights, and they find out, you know, as they arrive at the arena, that Evgeny Malkin's not going to play. That's a big loss, okay? I get that. And then, you know, Jari's struggling. They put in Casey DeSmith, and he gets hurt, and then Jari has to go back in. But the second one was in Pittsburgh, and the Rangers won that game. And, you know, the way the Rangers have filled their holes, Andrew Kopp, the versatility that he brings, Tyler Motte, what he brings to the fourth line, you know, obviously, I think they have the edge in goal. They might have the edge in goal against every team save for the Tampa Bay Lightning. I used to think that Pittsburgh was a better team. Now I'm kind of leaning that the Rangers are a better team than the Pittsburgh Penguins. But you're right. I think if and when they play in the playoffs, it's going to be a great series. It's going to be close. And it's a 6 or 7 game series easy.
Yeah, no, I believe that to be true. And the other thing that moved the Rangers for me was the way they played Pittsburgh in that second game. That was a low event, as Mike Sullivan put it. That was a low event affair. There were not a lot of scoring chances. Maybe the most scoring chances came in the last 2 minutes when the goalie was pulled and the Rangers had like 5 chances and defensemen were playing goal and posts were hit. And then Gensel comes back the other way and you're like, oh, this is where the Penguins tie. And he had 2 really good chances and couldn't convert on either one of them. But that was maybe the most wide open the game got. And to me, that's the question for the Rangers is, can they clamp it down? You know, we talked about it with Edmonton. They can't, you know, they can get up 2-1, 3-2, whatever it is. And as the other team, you're almost licking your lips. You're like, okay, now we turn it on. Now we push and watch them crumble. If I had questions about the Rangers, they're being answered the way they shut that game down and they just suffocated the Penguins and never let him breathe.
And Chris Kreider keeps scoring, man. He's got 46 goals, you know, and he's 3 off as we speak right now. He's 3 off the lead. There's 2 guys ahead of him, Leon Draisaitl and Austin Matthews, each with 49. I mean, we're going to hit 250 goal scorers very, very soon, you know, here in the NHL. Kreider, I think he's going to get there. You got Ovechkin at 42, Kyle Connor at 40. We got 5 40 goal scorers already, and there are 24 30 goal scorers. And this kind of goes back. We'll talk a little bit about the GM meetings where I was. One of the things that I wrote about at the GM meetings was scoring being up. And, you know, the NHL made a presentation, state of the league presentation to the general managers about, and scoring being up was part of it. It's 6.2 goals per game right now. And that is the pace here that we're at. And that's higher than what we've seen in a while, but it was 5.9 goals per game on November 28th. At the quarter mark of the season, it was 5.9. Now it's 6.2. Typically, and Sean, you know this, goal scoring typically goes down as the season moves along. This season, it's going up. In fact, it's the largest rise in goal scoring from the first quarter of the season to what the projection is for the end of the season in 30 years. So scoring is up. Connor McDavid just got his 100th point, right? I mean, Leon Draisaitl is going to get 50. Austin Matthews is going to get 50, maybe 60 for both. It's pretty remarkable what we're seeing right now with scoring in the NHL.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, the rise has been fueled on regular, even strength goals.
78% of the goals scored this season have been even strength goals. By comparison, 05-06, the first year out of lockout, 61%.
Yeah, no, it's been great. But you just mentioned all those guys, and I'm curious, before we get to the GM meetings with all of this offensive firepower that's going on. You just mentioned Connor at 100 points, Austin Matthews on the brink of 50 goals, Connor's teammate Leon Draisaitl on the brink of 50 goals and 100 points, Chris Kreider just carrying the Rangers offensively. Which one of those is the MVP?
Man, I was hoping you weren't going to ask me this question. Because, like, I'm so torn. I really am. I'm looking.
Is it any of them?
Of the guys you just mentioned, it's Austin Matthews for me. Okay. He absolutely drives the bus, I think, for the Toronto Maple Leafs. His size does it. His goal scoring does it. They rely, you know, like they rely so heavily on his ability to get to the net and to score. I think he's going to get 60 this season. I do. And Leon Draisaitl could as well, but Leon's got Connor, right? And you could say, oh, okay, Austin Matthews has Mitch Marner. He's not Connor McDavid. He's not. And similarly, flip it around. Well, Connor's had a great year and he has. Well, he's got Leon, right? And flip it around. Well, Austin's got Mitch Marner. Not the same, right? It's just, I mean, and that's with all due respect to Mitch Marner. So I'm looking at it and I'm saying it's Austin Matthews, but Igor Shesterkin. Like, I'm still kind of on that bandwagon that Igor Shesterkin has been the biggest reason for the Rangers' success this season. And really, just until recently, as they filled out their lineup, he is the most important player on that team. He's without question the MVP of that team. They're not where they are right now without his play. And I say that and I look at it and it's 24 comeback wins. Why are they able to get those comeback wins? Yes, partially because their power play has been great. And Chris Kreider's got 24 power play goals of his 46 or 24 on the power play. But because Igor keeps him in it, right? And that's the thing. He keeps him in it and he gives him the chance. And he, you mentioned it before, he's just having one of those seasons. And we've seen it with goalies before. Dominic Hasek, Carey Price, when they have one of those seasons, they get the Hart Trophy. Kind of lean in that direction still.
Still haven't hit on the winner. First of all, I don't think, and I know this is a hugely unpopular opinion, but Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl might not be in my top five.
Fair. Well, look, I mean, you got to play 200 feet, right? So
it's not even that. It's could would the Edmonton Oilers be who they are with just Connor McDavid? Yes, they would be a middling team fighting for their playoff lives. Would they be that with just Leon Draisaitl? Yes. Like, you can't be the MVP of the league if you can't even figure out if he's the MVP of his team.
Right. Who's like, your guy?
Roman Josi.
Fair.
Roman Josi is fair. Carrying the Nashville Predators. His 81 points. He could get to 100 points. Him and Cale Makar could each get to 100 points. Hasn't happened since Brian Leetch. But it's bigger than that. He's got, like, what, 25 points more than anybody else on the team? 13 points. Sorry, math was never my strong suit. He's a defenseman.
He's a defenseman with 13 more points. And they got a 37-goal scorer in Philip Forsberg, by the way.
Yeah, and he plays 25 minutes. He's playing almost half the game. He's better in his own end than anybody gives him credit for, and they would not be a playoff team without him. They wouldn't.
Look, if they make the playoffs and he approaches 100 points, that's a fair case for Roman Josi. I mean, you're not going to hear an argument from me on that one. Because, again, it's typically a forward, right? We typically see the forward get this award. I'm mentioning the goalie and Shesterkin just having one of those years. For a defenseman to get the Hart Trophy, it's got to have one of those seasons that are just so out of this world. And if the Nashville Predators get in and Roman Josi approaches 100 points or exceeds it, John, I'll throw up my arms and I might vote him number one too.
Yeah, and I'm so frustrated for years, and I've made this argument. The MVP award is the most valuable player. It is not the best player in the NHL. Like, nobody's going to argue that Connor McDavid and Austin Matthews and Leon Draisaitl are the three best players in the NHL. They are.
They are.
Right? Offensively, what they do, they're the three most skilled players.
Sidney Crosby's still in that mix.
Yeah. They're the three most skilled players in the NHL right now. But that's not. I don't know where in the MVP it says the most skilled player on his team. It says the most valuable player, the player that a team can least do without.
Mm-hmm.
Roman Josi.
Yeah.
Case closed. I rest.
All right. Hey, let's see. That's why they got to play the full 82 for us to really.
I bet you can't even name three other defensemen on the Nashville Predators.
Dante Fabro, I'm not going to do it. quickly, GM meeting. So a couple of news items that came out of there. Cap's going up $1 million, 82.5 for next season. That's what we expected. They're hoping that the players pay back the escrow by the 24-25 season, in which case after that, we'll kind of see the cap have a big jump. But right now, a $1 million jump, which everyone expected. Revenues, Gary Bettman said, should be north of $5 billion this season. When you consider everything the world has gone through in the last 2 years, that was the projection in December. It remains that projection. So that's good for the NHL. The no trade thing, you mentioned the Evgeny Dadonov thing, right? So they're the reason that happened, the trade from Vegas to Anaheim having to get canceled by the league, is because he's got a no trade clause that was never reported. Central Registry that handles all of this stuff didn't know about it. Well, now they're going to try to, at least they're working with the NHLPA to centralize this. So all no trade clauses in contracts go, the documentation of that goes to Central Registry for all new contracts. They'll build a database of all no trades. So this will not happen again if all that happens. And then there was the big discussion on long-term injured reserve and what to do with guys at the end of the season and, you know, playoffs, since there's no cap and there's nobody really thinks that anybody's abusing the long-term injured reserve clause, if you will, in the collective bargaining agreement, which allows, you know, if you're injured, you put them on LTIR and he doesn't count against your cap. It's just a discussion at this point, and it doesn't seem like Gary Bettman right now thinks it's a front. In fact, he said it's not a front burner issue, but that was some of the discussions and stuff that went on, a little bit of the news at the GM meetings, which I was very thankful to be at.
Yeah. I can't even believe that we're having this LTIR discussion and the abuse of it. Nobody's abusing LTIR.
I agree.
Like you think that the Vegas Golden Knights right now are sitting with a bunch of guys at LTIR and said, well, they're healthy, but we're not going to play them. We might miss the playoffs, but screw it. Like, we're just not going to put them in because it's really going to help us when we get to the playoffs. How do you go to a player? Players are playing through punctured lungs, broken hands, whatever it might be. How do you go to a player, especially a star player, and say, you know what would really help the team is if you set out the next 13 games. I know you could play, but maybe you're a little hurt. Yeah, just sit. Watch your teammates suffer. It'll all be better when we get to the playoffs. You're still going to get paid. It's all good. Like, it's baloney. It is a completely made-up thing from fans who are angry that other teams benefit from it because a player was actually hurt at the time it happened.
Yeah, I agree with it. But where do you stand on some sort of salary cap in the playoffs? Right now, there isn't a salary cap in the playoffs because rosters expand in the playoffs, and it's harder to do that. That's the reason why there isn't a cap in the playoffs. But there's, you know, even Gary Bettman allowed for the thought that that is something that potentially could happen down the road. Again, not a front burner issue now. Nobody is really dying for it. But what is your thought on that?
Yeah, I could see if you made it work to have the 23-man lineup reach some threshold, maybe the salary cap plus 10% to give you a little bit of leeway. And you know, you carry as much as you want salary-wise, but you have to fit it under a threshold in the game. I don't think that's a huge issue. And you know, you go from there. But again, like, that's all technicalities. Yeah, like, it is what it is. I mean, teams get advantages, healthy players come back, and that's just the way life is in hockey.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's my feeling on it. There's no need to. All right, the last thing before we go did happen during the GM meetings as well. Eugene Melnyk, the owner of the Ottawa Senators, passed away of illness at the age of 62, young age of 62. Pierre Dorion, the general manager for the Ottawa Senators, got up and spoke to the managers Tuesday morning after a moment of silence there. And then he spoke to the media, very emotional. It was an emotional time, Gary Bettman as well. So just wanted to pass along our condolences, obviously, to the Melnyk family and the entire Ottawa Senators family, and frankly, the Ottawa community, because the man did a lot in the Ottawa community.
He did a lot in Ottawa community. He saved hockey in Ottawa. He's the one who bought the team out of bankruptcy, kept them in Ottawa. You know, I'll never forget when they went to the Stanley Cup final and they played the Ducks. He basically flew the whole organization out to California. Like everybody, like secretaries, like anybody that worked for the team, salespeople, here's a ticket, here's a hotel. And if you can't make it because of family or whatever, here's some money to kind of offset what I'm doing for everybody else. Like, you know, there were issues, there were conflicts. He was a very outspoken person, you know, cared passionately about the Senators and how they should be run and where they should play and everything else that went on. But he cared deeply for the community. He was very philanthropic, and he'll certainly be missed. And I thought, you know, it was really appropriate a lot of the things Pierre Dorion said, and then saying that, you know, they'll finish the business that they started with Eugene Melnyk. And obviously it's a reference to the renaissance that they believe is going to happen in Ottawa sooner rather than later, where they'll be a competitive team again and competing for the Stanley Cup. And, you know, I hope that does happen. And it would be a great tribute to a man who, you know, did a lot for the Senators in the time he owned them.
Definitely. Absolutely. He was 62 years old. So that'll do it for this episode of At the Rink. We thank Emily Benjamin for jumping on with us, Sean. And of course, wherever you're listening to this, rate and review us. Let us know how we're doing. Send us questions at The Rink on Twitter. And as always, enjoy the hockey.